I will be honest with you. We had two very successful mystery writers who were booked to be on this morning's program. But after what happened in Baton Rouge yesterday and after what happened over the past 10 days, I got really uncomfortable with the idea of talking about police and crime as entertainment. We'll have those authors on in the days to come, but this morning I wanted to talk to Dr. Frankie Bailey instead. She is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany. She studies crime history and crime and mass media and popular culture, and she is also the author of several mystery novels and is also the author of two police procedurals featuring Albany police detective Hannah Stewart, and I am very glad that she is with us this morning. Frankie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an important conversation.
It is an important conversation. It seems, you know, I was struck by this yesterday. I was thinking about, because months ago, weeks ago, having a bunch of mystery authors on to talk about summer reading seemed like a really good idea. And now it just seems weird to me to, especially in light of what happened yesterday, and certainly what happened in Dallas, to be looking at this. And I know that this is your field of study, of looking at the history of crime, but also of how it is covered in the media. So let me ask you the giant question, which is the huge one, which is, how did we get to this point, do you think? Is this something that is recent, of our own making, or is it just been brewing around for a really long time?
Yeah, I think that's the difficulty we are having in coming together as a country to discuss this, because people are not in agreement about what's relevant to that discussion. As a crime historian, I would say that we need to go back to the beginning and come forward looking at what's happening in terms of those encounters between European Americans and African Americans and Hispanics and Asian Americans and all of those people who are meeting and coming into conflict. And we need to look at the 19th century when the police force itself comes into being, the modern police department, and why that department's created, and the idea that the police are there not only to enforce the law, but for social control, and how that gets played out as people are moving into the cities and as change is occurring. But for people who are coming into this conversation without that perspective, then it seems that, yeah, that happened, you know, 400 years ago, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, but it's no longer relevant to the conversation. And so they would want to start with what's happening now or what's been happening in the past 5 years. And then so people are talking past each other, and it's really hard to get people to the same point where they agree about what's relevant.
Does it go along with just our natural inclination recently to be so polarized politically?
I think we have always been polarized politically. I think one of the things, you're looking at this in terms of media, back in the 1960s when the civil rights movement was going on, television news, you really got a boost because of its coverage of the civil rights movement, and television was so important to that movement. Now we're dealing with social media and traditional media, and people are getting their information from so many sources, and now you can pick and choose a source that reflects your own beliefs and political leanings, and so there is no one trusted source or no three trusted sources if we're talking about network. There is no Walter Cronkite. There is no one that, you know, most Americans would agree is providing them with true information. And there is so much information coming at us so quickly. We're being bombarded not just by what's happening in this country, but what's going on in Paris and Turkey and all the other places in the world that are going to affect us in some way. And so we're all on edge, and we're all dealing with all of this information, and we're trying to figure out what's true and what can be believed. And it's coming at us in a new way, in a sense that you can have a woman sitting in a car with a police officer outside that car holding a gun, and she's talking to the police, and she's talking to her followers on Facebook, and we're seeing this happen in real time, and we're seeing police officers scrambling as they're being shot at by a sniper, and it's all happening in real time. And so, you know, how do we, that mediation by the media is happening at a different pace.
One of the things that I find interesting about that, and I know this has been brought up certainly in the last 2 weeks, and that is this idea that we have to take a side here, meaning that okay, well, the Black Lives Matter movement is right on this and the police are wrong, or the police are right on this and the Black Lives Matter movement, or whoever is happens to be demonstrating in that particular point, or whatever citizenry we're talking about that's being protected by whatever police force, that there has to be a side taken. How do we get out of that mindset?
It's so difficult because if you saw some of the ABC town hall with President Obama, and the response to that, when you try to stand in the middle, as some leaders are trying to do, and talk about the perspectives of both sides, then each side feels that you're not completely understanding what's happening with them. And so that makes the conversation, even among ordinary people, difficult because as an academic, when I try to talk to my students, for example, there's so much emotion involved, so much fear and anger and uncertainty. And we have very bad role models, frankly, in terms of some of the people who are on media and yelling at each other as the anchor person tries to act as the referee. And so that idea of civil, calm conversation where you try to reflect empathy towards the other person's point of view. That's a very difficult skill for us to exercise. It's a skill that some of us have never learned, and that even those of us who try have a hard time applying, because you can't talk about both sides at the same time. And if you're saying, here, I understand the police and what they're saying, they have a difficult job, they are, as the chief in Dallas said, being forced to do all the jobs that other agencies should be dealing with. You're there. Even James Baldwin talked about this back in the 1960s, that in a ghetto, the police become the occupying army, and they're, the way that citizens are seeing them reflects how citizens are seeing white society as a whole. And then you try to talk about, Black Lives Matters and what they're saying about the failure of respectable civil rights, that movement, the fact that we're in many places, that we have mass incarceration, we have the failed war on drugs, we have families, we have children that have been harmed. And so that respectable old school way of protesting just doesn't work anymore. And this is a youth culture, trying to talk about things in a new way. When you try to talk about both of those groups and be fair to both groups, you often get slammed by both groups who are saying, you're not talking about both of us at the same time, you don't understand.
When you think of all of the issues that are tied together here, race, of course, racial relations, as well as police, policing, our criminal justice system, and guns, and politics.
Yeah.
And this all, I'm leaving out a lot, but it's all coming together, and it seems that there is difficulty in trying to figure out, okay, this is what we need to address at this moment. And you would think that something like the events of both in Dallas and Baton Rouge would give us a tragedy, obviously, but an opportunity to look at it and say, okay, so where do we go from here? I was struck by what you said a moment ago, the town hall that took place on ABC. And it seemed like that started, it was trying to be a very reasoned conversation, but I don't know that anybody paid attention to it.
Well, I came in late to the conversation because I was thinking it was at 9 o'clock. It was actually earlier.
Yes.
And I haven't listened to the whole thing. I've only seen quotes from it, but it does seem there was a reasoned conversation, but at the same time, there was a sense that because of the shootings, that sympathy was weighed towards the police, and that what had happened with citizens, police shootings involving citizens, was being forgotten in that discussion. And it reflected that idea that respectable conversations people are sometimes now impatient with those conversations, respectful conversations, respectable conversations, the idea, the politics of respectability, that somehow that to have that kind of reasoned conversation becomes more difficult when people are on edge and stressed, and we all are. And so that's finding those calm moments when we can talk is more and more difficult. But I think you're right. We have an opportunity because I think most people of goodwill would agree that we have reached a tipping point. We can't go on like this. We can't normalize the kind of violence we've been seeing towards citizens or towards police officers. We got to find some way to talk about the problem and understand each other's perspectives and find some middle ground and understand what we have in common. When we look at police, for example, and Black males, they have a lot in common. I mean, when you think about this in terms of their history and the fact that they're on, you know, the line facing each other, but they're representing so much about what's going on in society. They are, as you know, scholars have observed, they're both oppressed minorities in various ways. And they're both stigmatized and stereotyped. And they both come to those encounters, you know, Black male and police officer, wanting respect, wanting the other person to understand his or her humanity, wanting to come out of that encounter unharmed. And I'm talking about people of goodwill here, not the people who are out to do bad things. But you know, the police officers are trained, socialized to take control of the situation because that's the way they are taught. They protect themselves and they protect other people. And everyone gets out of that encounter, you know, safe. Black males coming to the encounter are coming to the encounter with bringing everything that they know as Black males and have heard as Black males about police and about what happens in those encounters to that encounter. And the same is true of the police. And it makes it much more difficult for them to, for individual officer, individual male to look across those barriers and see each other and understand, I'm as scared of you as you are of me at this moment, and we need to try to figure out how to get out of this. You know, respecting each other, not harming each other, understanding where we are.
Right. And having a some level, I'm not saying it has to be a high level, but some level of trust. Meaning,
yeah.
Okay, if you go to get your registration out of your glove compartment, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going for a gun.
Yeah.
Just before we came on this morning, moments ago, the fourth Baltimore police lieutenant was acquitted on all the charges in the Freddie Gray case. I bring that up because it's the fourth straight trial where prosecutors have failed to win in the case. This is a Black man who was critically injured in a police transport van and eventually died. Now, we don't know what happened, really. We have reports. There's conflicting reports. But now there have been four trials.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to many of us who view this, see it as a tragedy and something where somebody did something wrong.
Well, we do know that we have institutionalized racism. I mean, we do know that racial profiling occurs. And when I was talking about the police officers of goodwill who go into a traffic stop, you know, trying to do their rightful duty,
right.
And as opposed to people, police officers who may harass, you know, Black males, who may force an encounter, who may engage in brutality and all of the things that people talk about. And I think, you know, the difficulty with this is that, you know, clearly there is some, even in those situations where the police officer may be technically justified, I'm not saying that's true of the Freddie Gray case or any of the other more recent cases. I'm not saying it's untrue, but I'm, you know, saying that. That even in those cases where there may be some justification, the problem is that there is this sense that justice is not being done, that this is one more incident, one more example. And there is a loss of faith in the criminal justice system. It's not restricted only to Black males and people in poor communities, I think. I think being exposed to the videos, hearing these discussions, more people are beginning to think there is something going wrong, that even if police are trying to do their job, and most police officers are good cops who go into these communities trying to engage in community policing, trying to do the right thing, that something's going wrong in these encounters. And the problem is, and I think most people would acknowledge this, that when there are a few bad police officers, they actually create this stigma, this, you know, stereotype that affects all police officers. And I think, you know, police officers are saying, well, we're, you know, most of us are good cops. And that's, I'm sure, true of most cops. But at the same time, this failure of the police and I think, you know, most people believe that the deck in a courtroom is really stacked against the victim and the victim's family, that citizens historically have wanted to believe the police because they are representing society. And if you fail to believe that they are telling the truth and give them the benefit of the doubt, then you're putting them in danger. You're saying that, you know, maybe you're not doing this right, and it makes their job much more difficult.
I don't know, I'm just using the Freddie Gray case. I mean, you don't know, obviously we don't know everything. But what we do know, and what I would assume, is that as you see this yet another trial where there is, where another officer has been acquitted, there has to be, there just has to be a rage upon the family and the community in that. And how do you harness that? How do you harness that to say, okay, because then everything that, because that dynamic of trust and that dynamic of a police officer working in a community, that's shot to hell.
Yeah.
So what
that's
do you...
That's the sad part about people are really trying to do community policing, and people are trying to engage with the police, and every time this happens, then they're pushed further apart in terms of those conversations.
Do you have about another 10 minutes or 15 minutes or so? Okay. I would like to extend our conversation. We'll go to a news break at the bottom of the hour, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more about these issues. Frankie Bailey is our guest this morning. She is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany. She studies crime history and crime in mass media and popular culture, and it's a great privilege to have her on the program this morning. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to our conversation this morning. Our guest is Dr. Frankie Bailey. She is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany. She studies crime history and crime in mass media, popular culture. She's also the author of several mysteries, including two police procedural novels featuring Albany Police Detective Hannah Stewart. And it's a great pleasure to have Dr. Bailey with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being able to stay with us. As a historian of this, and I started off by asking how we got to this point, and I guess my thought in asking that question was an assumption, perhaps wrongly so on my part, that we've reached a real, and I believe you even used tipping point, but we've reached a point where maybe. Is this the worst we've ever seen it in our history? Now, obviously, there have been periods of history where horrible things have happened and there has been great distress. But we have to look at this period and say that this is one of them, don't we?
Yeah, I think the things we were talking about during the break, you know, just in terms of the question, is it worse or does it seem worse because we're so aware of what's going on? It's impossible to escape from the information that we're getting. You know, something, we get the breaking news and we tune in to see what's happening. Is it happening here? Is it happening in Paris? Is it going to affect me in one way or another? There are so many voices and so many loud voices. And we talk about this idea of rage. It's a kind of rage that may be reflecting in part our political season, but also reflecting the fact that people feel it's normalized now to yell at other people in the midst of discourse. And we've done that in the past. I mean, not to say that Americans haven't always been loud and forceful and getting their opinions out there. But now in those settings where in the past we might have had more calm and reasoned discussion, that now that rage is coming out and it is less unacceptable than in the past. And we're normalizing to the extent that violence becomes normalized. Violence has become normalized where we're desensitized to some extent. And even when we're shocked, it's, the news media has tried to personalize the victims of violence, to talk about them individually, but at the same time, it's so overwhelming that when a new incident happens, whether it's a citizen or police officers, then the need to, in some ways, we're trying to protect ourselves, I think. I'm not a psychologist, but I think protecting ourselves against all of that violence coming at us, all of the rage that we would be feeling, all of the shock and fear. And so, it's more difficult to have that and that discussion about it, and it seems things are worse. And in many ways they are, in the sense that we are more divided and we have our own little, you know, we're retreating into our own corners and we're, you know, not hearing each other.
You talked about in our first part of our conversation about social media and obviously the impact, and we all see so many more of these incidents now are on tape. And well, not on tape, but in that digital thing that we have,
or YouTube, or Facebook,
whatever it is, yes, the capability to see these events. I was struck yesterday when I was watching the coverage of out of Baton Rouge, and the 24-hour news networks were just showing a snippet of tape over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I was watching. I was watching police officers run across the screen. And there was a shopping center. I don't know from whose vantage point. And Frankie, I got to tell you, I watched for 2.5 hours. I don't think they ever told me what I was watching.
Yeah.
And I feel that when you mentioned disconnect, I don't know. Now, I don't know what I was supposed to get out of that. I don't know what I was supposed to know from it. And here's the scary thing. And I say this as a person in the media. I don't know that they knew. They had a piece of tape. I don't know what it was, but that has such an impact on us. And I understand when they say, okay, here is the event, here is the traffic stop that happened in Baton Rouge, or here's the traffic stop that happened in Minnesota. Okay, there is the beginning, the middle, and an end. Yeah. But sometimes we just see these clips, and I don't know what they are, and I don't know how we put them into a context.
And it's really difficult because if you look at the cable news or, you know, traditional network news, but even more so with cable news because of that 24-hour cycle they're on, there are so many videos, as you talk about, where we're looking at things sent in by a citizen journalist or a witness at the scene, and we don't know the perspective even of the reporters. Where are they as they're filming this? But I think, you know, in terms of media, there's always been this. And we, you know, look at this in terms of research, this distortion of crime and justice in the media simply because of, you know, breaking news and continuing coverage and all of the things that have always applied. But, you know, in the past, there has been more control over the images that we're seeing because they were usually being produced by the media. And we could say, well, this may or may not be true or representative of what was going on, but at least we know the source. And now when we're looking at all of these images and when there's this need for visuals that we're that, you know, they're feeding on, and there's this continuing loop that we talk about where we see things over and over again and we see them out of context and we see them with new commentary and we see your anchor people coming in and out of the chair, your change and being repeated and reinterpreted as the consultants are coming in and they're looking at this and they're saying, what are you seeing here? And so, you know, the sense that media is always distorted because of the nature of media, always stood between us and the reality or the you know, actual event that is happening more and more. And I think, you know, one of the problems for most of us is that most Americans get the information that they have about crime and justice from the media. And now the media itself is out of balance and distorted in so many ways. And there's so many, and there's the political continuum in terms of where the media fall and what they're showing and how they interpret it. And if you read discussion boards and headlines, or if you're getting your news, as some people do, from blogs and, you know, Comedy Central or, you know, Saturday Night Live. I mean, so people are getting information from so many sources. And as you said, those sources are not providing context.
The idea of, and you mentioned it, where we're showing the video and then we don't have any new information and we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. So then comes the speculation. And I was horrified yesterday in watching, because at one point they were speculating and they kept on saying over and over again that, you know, the information, they didn't know what was true, but they were getting reports that up to 8 officers perhaps were
mm-hmm.
killed.
Yeah.
But to me, that if you have an unstable community environment, and then that is then being reported, especially when you are on the scene with a camera, that plays, you are then becoming a factor in the news that you are covering, right? I mean, it can incite what is happening. I think the best example of that perhaps is what we saw in Ferguson after the verdicts.
Yeah, it's not a completely new thing. If you think back to the Rodney King riots,
sure.
with Reginald Denny, the truck driver who's caught up in what was going on, and then you have citizens watching the news and going out in real time and getting him out of that situation, or we're watching the helicopters flying overhead in when rebellions or riots, whatever your choice of words, going on in communities, and we have that real time kind of thing. But you're right in the sense that, and that happens not just in police shootings, but hostage takings, school shootings, any type of situation that's fluid. There is that speculation that we don't know the details. This is what we're hearing. But I think, the Kerner Commission pointed out a long time ago when they were looking at riots in the 1960s that's one of the most problematic elements of those types of conflicts and the types of things we're looking at now, where people are getting rumors and information that has not been verified. And that those rumors, that there is this need to control the information, not control in the sense of deny information, but to make sure that the information getting out to people is the best information available. I think that's why you're seeing more and more police departments trying to get out in front and coming out and saying, we're going to do a press conference and we will give you this information, all the information we can provide, because they're trying to prevent the speculation. But with breaking news, when it's still happening, when the conflict is still ongoing, that's the problem that we have, and particularly when we now have people involved in the conflict watching and listening to what's going on and responding to it in real time. So
I'm also curious, as I said, there are many forces at work here, and one of course is race. You're an African-American woman, I'm a white male. But what do we bring to that? I mean, it's not just that, right? Of how we go through and the lens of which we look at. There can be an understanding of I understand what you're experiencing, or maybe I can't. I don't know the answer to that, of how we come to I understand what you've been through and you understand what I am allowed to do or not allowed to do. And how do we come to that?
Yeah, I think that's our historical difficulty in terms of public memory, in terms of American memory. I mean, it's like the debate we have every year about Columbus. Is he villain or hero? The whole idea that your heroes are sometimes my villains in terms of how we think about where we are. But I think what we can do is try to approach it with goodwill and at least try to listen and exercise imagination. I think sometimes we have a failure of imagination where we have people saying, in my community, I feel unsafe. I have my schools are failing my children. I'm dealing with food insecurity. All of these things are affecting me. And you say, and racial profiling is happening. That's the reality for me. That's what I see. I'm being stopped over and over again. And people say, well, yeah, but we're talking about what happens in those encounters. And the police are saying, well, yeah, I'm going out and I'm walking this beat and I'm feeling in danger and this is why. And people are saying, well, yeah, but you're dangerous to me. And there's a failure to, I think, oddly enough, the moments when we are most able to step into the other person's shoes is oddly enough at those memorial services where you're the families and you're able to see that real pain and heartbreak, whatever, however those families got there, that this is, people are suffering. Children are left without fathers, wives, or husbands, without a spouse or a partner. And there is that real human emotion, but it comes at a price. And the price is a continuing level of violence that's unacceptable, and that we can't move past that moment when we see each other as humans and are able to step across this line dividing us, and where you can say to me, I'm a white male and this is how I see the world and I haven't had your experience growing up in the South. I grew up in the last capital of the Confederacy, and I grew up with people talking about honor and race. And
right.
So coming to New York, this whole discussion about some things are very foreign to me. I don't understand, for example, religious prejudice in the same way that a Northerner might, because my focus growing up was about race and that divide. And so you're understanding white males and how they see the world. Your vision is probably different from the white males that I grew up with. But you know, there is still that possibility that we could exercise some imagination, allow each other to speak and hear each other and try to step into that person's shoes. Even when we disagree, even when we believe that person is wrong, from our point of view, to understand why that person believes as he or she does.
Philando Castile was, who was killed in Minnesota, fatally shot on July 6th. According to the New York Times, in a 13-year span of time, was pulled over by the police in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region 49 times.
Yeah.
An average of about once every 3 months. All, from the records, minor infractions. Driving at night with an unlit license plate.
Mm-hmm.
Driving with tinted windows.
Yeah.
Perhaps driving, doing many of the things that I do every single night when I drive home.
And you're white male. Yeah.
Right. So I ask it in the form of a question, in the sense that, in the context of what we were just talking about, how do you look at that? I guess you can look at that statistic and say, well, look, obviously he was doing something wrong, so they had reason to pull him over. I'm not saying that he deserved to be shot, but my God, look, he'd been pulled over 49 times over 13 years. Or you look at it and say, well, that's just harassment. I mean, is a black man who's just trying to go from here to there and has been pulled over 49 times in 13 years seems ridiculous.
There's a phrase, white privilege, that some white males and white females are able to begin to understand and, you know, use that as a part of the conversation, but it angers other people when you say white privilege. But that is, you know, one of the privileges of being white, that you can weave in and out and be on your cell phone or have a seatbelt unbuckle, and that you are not, you're going to be stopped for some reason. And for black males, you're stopped over and over again. The suspicion is, I'm not being stopped just because of my taillight or my seatbelt. I'm being stopped because this gives you the ability to stop me, question me, perhaps even reach the point where you're searching my car, that this stop is not just going to be a casual stop. But from the police officer's point of view, where you're in some cases, they may really be stopping for a reason that they consider legitimate, but they are stopping. There is this kind of, when they are doing much of their policing in poor and black communities, where the war on drugs has been fought in those communities, where law and order is being preserved in those communities, and people feel that they're being controlled in those communities, any kind of, even a legitimate stop, begins to look like racial profiling when you're stopped 40-plus times and you're black male. I mean, what else can you say about that? Because you're right. Pretty sure that folks like you aren't being stopped as you drive home, you're wherever you're going, 46 times. And
now, I've been pulled over for stupid things. I don't want to say that, but certainly not 49 times.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's not normal for you.
Right.
It's something that is atypical, out of the ordinary. And as a middle-class white male, when you're pulled over, you have this reasonable, respectful conversation, usually, one assumes.
Yes.
And then you go about your business. But for black males, it's normalized to the point that, and particularly now, that you're any stop, and this is, you know, the conversation that black parents have with their children about what you do in that situation. This is, you know, the Center for Law and Justice has been doing legal rights workshops to talk to children, you know, about, you know, what you do in that situation, young people about, well, not children because they wouldn't be driving, but young people, about what you do in that situation when you're stopped, and how you don't escalate the situation. You try to understand what's going on and try not to make it worse. But at the same time, you know, as a black teenager, a black young male, or black female for that matter, you have to say, you know, why should I be forced into this situation where I have to try to accommodate what seems to me racial discrimination?
I don't know. It makes no sense to me. I mean, I understand certainly the idea that we have to train and teach young African Americans, mixed race, and other minorities that the deck is not stacked cleanly, and that they do have to take that into concern. But it seems to me to be a horrible commentary on what we're dealing with, that there has to be this behavior in a perfect world, we're all civil to one another, and when you get pulled over. But I got to say, if just in my white privilege, if I'm pulled over 49 times,
you have to wonder.
You know, at some point, you're gonna get ticked off, right? I mean, you're not gonna be able to have that composure. It's just a natural thing. And then for the repercussions, yes, it's rare, but that you're gonna get shot as a result of it. I don't know how to compute that in my brain.
I think that's a part of it. We're dealing not just with anger, but with weariness. I mean, people are just so tired of trying to arrange their lives so that they're accommodating what they see as, whether or not it is the case in that particular stop, but what they see as a pattern of, it's the individual officer may be acting with goodwill, but I think what people are trying to say is that we're dealing with institutionalized racism, where the system goes on. Good people come and go in a system, but the system continues to function in a certain way that it works against certain groups of people. And poor people and people of color are more likely to be stopped than people like you, or even like me. I mean, I have a certain class privilege that I'm able to exercise to some extent when I'm stopped. So it's not just, it's the intersection of race and gender and class and social location and those encounters that you have. And for the police officers, it's, where they're policing and the people they're coming in contact with. I mean, there's so many things, time of day, whether this is a neighborhood where drugs are sold, what type of activities they're involved in. And proactive activities by the police have often been activities that lead to more encounters. And those encounters begin to build up for those young people who are stopped over and over again, or older people as well.
Frankie Bellio is our guest. She's a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany. We were talking earlier about how, as you said, this is an opportunity. We do have an opportunity to talk about this now. So in that opportunity, are you optimistic? I mean, are you optimistic that the I mentioned this earlier on in the program that I keep on seeing the headline, which says, "Nation on the Edge," and on CNN, and I believe there was a New York Times headline after Dallas of that we're weary and wary, and then you see the president come out yesterday and make a statement in the afternoon, and it's just like, really, I have to do this again?
I think he's really tired at this
point.
Yeah,
so,
obviously.
So where then does the optimism, I asked you a direct way. So do you have optimism? And if so, where does that come from? And if not, I completely understand.
If we gave up hope, we would be lost. I mean, seriously, we have to keep hoping.
I'll take that.
But I have optimism that we are dealing with a younger generation who may be less respectful in terms of their protests, but who understand the intersections of race, class, sexuality, religion, and all of that, and who try to treat each other better. But I also feel that this is a dangerous moment because in their efforts to talk about what they are feeling and experiencing, they are in many ways you're being perceived, and sometimes are, less respectful of their elders in terms of trying to sit down at the table with them. At the same time, I think that for police, they are feeling more and more in danger from vigilantes and others who are coming out. And I think every time we have another shooting of police officers, it makes it more difficult to sit down at the table and talk. And obviously citizens are also being shot, but I think when police officers are being shot and killed, then people who were about to begin to understand and open up to the conversation then draw back and say, we have these people are out there killing police officers who are trying to do their job, and obviously these are bad people. And obviously the people who do that are behaving in a completely unacceptable, horrific way, and they are endangering those conversations. But I'm optimistic that we have reached that tipping point where most of us understand that we've reached a divide, and either we you know, we do end up at each other's throats in one way or another, or we sit down and try to have conversations and figure out where to go from here.
You teach young people at the university. Are you optimistic? Because the conversations, and I teach two classes, not in your field, but in communications and journalism, and I become out of those thinking, oh, I feel pretty good about these kids. Do you come out that way?
Well, you know, sometimes I do, but I have a diverse, for example, I did a race and crime class, a graduate class last semester, and it was a very diverse class, and I had people from many walks of life, and they were able to have conversations, and I have to say, you know, they were very lively conversations when we had them, and they were coming from different points of view, and they were trying to understand each other, and I think that was important that they were, but I was also struck by the distance that they needed to cross to reach. And I had some police officers in the class, and they were very receptive to the conversations as well. But yeah, I'm optimistic about that in the sense that when you bring people from diverse backgrounds who are people of goodwill together, that they can sit down, particularly young people, and try to bridge those gaps and talk across those lines, and that they are, many of them willing to come to the table, you know, some are not, some are just fed up and you know, think there's no point in doing that. We've done that before and it had some work. I mean, it happened in the 60s and we see where we are and we're coming out of mass incarceration and all the other things. But there are other people who say, well, you know, we can protest and we can continue to protest, but we can also talk. And so I'm optimistic about that part of it.
Dr. Frankie Belli is professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany. I called her very late last night and asked her if she would be on the show, and she said yes, and I'm thrilled that you did. I thank you so much for giving up part of your Monday and coming in and talking about
this.
Thank
you for having me and you know engaging in this conversation.
A great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you. Again, Dr. Frankie Belli, and you can hear this interview in its entirety on our website, wamc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.